4th Street in Grand Rapids. They also offer a food pantry from 11 to 2, Monday through Thursday. November is Alzheimer's Awareness Month. If you are a caregiver of someone with this disease, the Alzheimer's Foundation of America has a helpline to provide support, answer questions, and connect you with resources. Find more info at alzfdn.org. The Bemidji Area's 100-plus Women Who Care event is Thursday, November 13th at South Shore Hotel on Lake Bemidji. Social hour begins at 5, with the event running from 6 to 7 p.m. The United Way of Bemidji Area's Holiday Gifts for Kids program is now accepting new, unwrapped gifts for those aged newborn through 17. Donations may be dropped at several locations in Bemidji now until December 8th, including the Tourist Information Center. Find more information and registration forms for families at unitedwaybemidji.org. Listen Saturdays at 2 p.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. for She Rose Radio, amplifying female voices in music with Carmel Holt. Now we'll take you back to Morning Edition.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The House is expected to vote today on a spending measure that could end the federal government shutdown. This is day 43. The Senate passed the measure earlier this week. If the House adopts it, it would go to President Trump for his signature. The shutdown is still causing more air traffic to slow down. The tracking site, FlightAware.com, says nearly 900 flights have been canceled today. There have been worries about reduced air traffic for Thanksgiving. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy says he was focused on airline delays at the end of this week.
If you thought this weekend was bad with delays and cancellations, truly this Thursday and Friday, I think you would have seen mass, double, triple the number of cancellations and delays in the airspace.
If the shutdown continues, Duffy has directed that air traffic in the U.S. be reduced 10% by Friday. More programs affected by the federal government shutdown are those that help Americans with food and utility bills. From member station WPLN in Nashville, Cynthia Abrams has more.
The federal government provides a number of supports to families in need. There's food aid, disability payments, and there's also a program that helps low-income families pay their gas or electric bills. Like SNAP, that's been delayed during the shutdown. The city of Nashville has put around $200,000 toward the gap, but
it does not even make a dent in the amount of families that you usually cover.
Lisa McCready-Beverly, with Nashville's Metro Action Commission, says the program usually receives $6 million in federal funding. Earlier this year, the Trump administration laid off the entire staff responsible for administering the energy assistance grants. For NPR News, I'm Cynthia Abrams in Nashville.
President Trump's recent pardons of 77 people linked to efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election do not apply to any state charges against the individuals. That includes Trump's one-time lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. He's involved in a criminal case in Georgia. From member station WABE in Atlanta, Alex Helmick reports.
The massive RICO case originally brought by Fulton County District Attorney Fawnie Willis still does not have a prosecuting attorney. That's after a Georgia court removed Willis because her relationship with a special prosecutor created an appearance of impropriety. The prosecuting attorney's counsel of Georgia has to name her replacement by November 14th or the indictments are dismissed. In a statement, the counsel's executive director, Pete Skandalakis, said Trump's pardons only apply to federal charges, not state, and his office is working on their assigned task without being influenced by outside actions. For NPR News, I'm Alex Helmick in Atlanta.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Frigid air is still settled over the South. There are frost and freeze warnings up this morning for parts of Florida and southern Georgia. Currently, it's just 25 degrees in Jacksonville, Florida. In comparison, farther north, it's 40 degrees in New York City. Meanwhile, the National Weather Service says a storm in the Pacific will deliver what's known as an atmospheric river to California this week. Forecasters say strong winds and heavy rain will pelt the state. There are winter storm warnings posted already for California's eastern mountains. Heavy snow is already forecast. Museums across the country had to cut programming and delay projects this year. That's according to a new report from the American Alliance of Museums. NPR's Andrew Limbong reports the industry's recovery from the pandemic is stalling.
When the federal government cut grants to museums earlier this year, that left a lot of museums with holes in their budgets. And then President Trump issued an executive order criticizing the Smithsonian's, quote, divisive race-centered ideology, which had an impact on all museums, said Marilyn Jackson, the president and CEO of the American Alliance of Museums.
We're seeing corporations and foundations thinking twice about funding certain projects or programs that they would have naturally funded in the past.
The top line result from this study is that museum attendance is down compared to last year. The outlook for 2026 doesn't look much brighter as museum leaders worry about further shifts in philanthropy and inflation. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
On Wall Street, in pre-market trading, stock futures are higher. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Total Wine and More, offering a variety of beverages for gatherings and crisp fall nights. More at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older.
KEXE means a lot to people, including our member services manager, Heather Johnson.
Had a little baby. He never stopped screaming for 2 years. He has since substituted that for talking nonstop. But
shout out to Alex.
Yeah, shout out to Alex. Great kid. Terrible baby. There was a lot of screaming, not much sleeping. So the radio was like constantly like my friend. Like, oh my gosh, thank goodness the morning show is on. And, oh, now there's somebody playing great music and everything. And it was just such a relief. And then I was working from home at that point, so I wasn't going into the office and seeing adults anyway. So it was just nice to hear adult voices, you know what was going on in this new town and know what we could do, like what I could take this little screaming thing to.
We need your support now. Go to KEXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you for being a part of this community.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
Enemy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Today, the House returns to take up legislation that would end the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. In a moment, we'll hear from Republican Congressman Mike Lawler.
We have also been hearing from Democrats, many of whom are upset with this deal and the handful of their Senate colleagues who voted for it.
NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales has been following this. So what, 43 days of a shutdown. Mm-hmm. Is this the end? Is this over with now?
It truly could be. House lawmakers will be back in town today for the first time since House Speaker Mike Johnson let them go home in September before the shutdown even began. The House Rules Committee met for more than 7 hours last night, and they moved this bill to the floor just a few hours ago, and that sets the stage for a final vote later tonight. And as you will recall, this deal came together after a group of Senate Democrats broke ranks to vote with Republicans to end the government shutdown, and they sent this bill to the House. Now, the package includes a stopgap measure to fund the government at least through the end of January, with full-year appropriations plans funding some of those federal agencies and services.
The thing is that Senate deal does not include anything about extending the health care subsidies that Democrats were dug in on. So What did they get instead?
Right, exactly. That was a key demand from Democrats. And this deal doesn't address that. Instead, they secured a promise for a vote in December on health care and a commitment to negotiate a plan to address those subsidies. Those who broke with the party in the Senate said they got the best deal possible. And that includes those full year appropriations plans, which were negotiated between the parties over several months. Meanwhile, other Senate Democrats who voted no argued they weren't making good to reopen the government in exchange for addressing these expiring Affordable Care Act subsidies that's spiking premiums. So those who are upset, it carries over to the House, and the fury is only worse there, where we expect most Democrats to vote no on this plan. Several progressives, for example, have called for Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer to be ousted from his leadership role, even as he voted no on the plan. And last night, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries dodged a question on this with reporters in terms of Schumer's role. And so a reminder, the party's really struggling to reconcile the various factions around this deal.
Claudia, the promise to vote in December on the Affordable Care Act subsidies, what might come out of that?
Well, we could see a deal come out of that possibly, but it's a very tall order. It's going to be a really difficult negotiation for Congress, especially in these ultra-partisan times. And we already know that Republicans have demands on ACA reforms that many Democrats won't be able to stomach, such as installing new restrictions for care related to abortions. And even if it can pass the Senate, it's not clear Speaker Mike Johnson will bring it up for a vote in the House. But we do know Democrats have warned if Republicans do not hold up their end of the deal and negotiate a plan to extend these subsidies, they will hold Republicans' feet to the fire when most of the government's funding ends January 30th under this current plan. So it could be something we're still talking about come next year and into the midterm elections.
And we'll be here for all of it. That's NPR's Claudia Grisales. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Let's hear a Republican view of all this. Congressman Mike Lawler represents a good part of upstate New York, suburbs of New York City. Congressman, welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Glad you're with us. Do you assume this is going to pass the House today?
It will, and there'll even be a few Democrats to vote for it, so it will be bipartisan. But this is, you know, 42 days overdue. It never should have happened. Chuck Schumer chose to shut the government down for his own political purpose, trying to appease a far-left radical base that wants him and Senate Democrats to fight back against President Trump. At the end of the day, that's what this was always about. It was not about health care. It was not about any specific policy issue. It was about, quote unquote, fighting back against Trump.
I think there's been a lot of analysis to that effect, that this was part of the Democrats' calculus. They felt they needed to fight. But there was this substantive issue on the table having to do with Obamacare subsidies. And assuming this passes today in the House, you move on. The Senate is going to at least vote on extending subsidies for Obamacare. House Speaker Mike Johnson is not guaranteed a vote in the House, though. Do you believe the House should vote on those subsidies?
I do. I've been a co-lead on a bill since the beginning of September to extend the ACA subsidies by 1 year. Remember, these were put in place during COVID to help ease the pressure on families in the middle of a health pandemic. These subsidies go directly to the insurance companies. And so the question really is the federal government paying 78% of the premium or 88% of the premium? That's what the fight is over right now. I'm supportive of extending it by a year, but it really requires a larger discussion, which is how do we actually make healthcare affordable? Because if you look at premiums since Obamacare took effect, 96% increase in the private insurance market since Obamacare took effect, and 114 to 125% increase in the Obamacare market since it took effect in 2010. That is unsustainable. It is not affordable. And it is something that we have to address long term. So there's the short term issue of the subsidy. Yeah. Is the longer term issue of how we actually reduce healthcare costs in America.
I guess we should note this is a Republican argument here. Obamacare was about extending healthcare to more people, but it was also supposed to be about bending the curve, as they said, bringing down costs over time. I think you're saying that part of it didn't work.
No question. And again, I think this is incumbent on all of us, Republicans and Democrats, to work together to address this. Everybody should be able to acknowledge that healthcare is not affordable. And if it's not affordable, that means that what was done did not work. And so the question is, how do we fix it? How do we actually make progress on improving upon the current situation? I'm not advocating for repeal and replace. I'm saying, let's look at this. Let's fix it. This is a problem for the American people.
I want to ask about another issue, Congressman, because you live in suburban New York, and I'm thinking about that area, and you must have a lot of constituents who might like to live in New York City, but they could never afford to live there. And New York City has now elected a mayor who says, I'm going to hold down the rent, I'm going to hold down costs and expenses, and that seems to have been a big factor in elections across the country last Tuesday. And President Trump is talking about it now, saying that maybe people should have 50-year mortgages so they can have a slightly lower mortgage payment. What do you make of all that, and what do you think that people should be focused on?
Look, affordability is the number one issue. It always has been. As James Carville famously said, it's the economy, stupid. If people cannot afford where they live, if they cannot afford to put food on the table, then other issues result. And so to me, that has to be the focus. I believe housing is a major crisis in this country. We're about 8 million units underbuilt nationwide. It's basic supply and demand. Healthcare costs, obviously, are a major challenge. Grocery bills are coming down, but still a challenge. And so the question is, how do we tackle this issue? You look at New York City and the irony of Zohran Mamdani claiming there's an affordability crisis. Democrats have controlled New York City for well over a decade. They've controlled New York State for well over two decades now. And you look at the challenges facing the state and the city. They've increased, for instance, state spending by $100 billion in 10 years. That creates the challenge of unaffordability. And so the question is,
in a few seconds, I just want to focus on the housing part of this. I can accept the argument that rent control hasn't worked very well for decades in New York. I'm not sure this 50-year mortgage really helps people's mortgage payments that much. But you talked about supply. Is there something you can do to increase the housing supply?
No question. I've introduced a bill to revitalize America's housing market. It's 208 pages, 39 provisions. The objective is to actually lessen the regulatory burden on housing, construction, and financing, making sure that we are opening up our capital markets to contractors and investors. There's key components to ease up, for instance, regulations on manufactured housing. In the most recent tax bill, we increased the low-income housing tax credit, which will help build 1 million units of housing over the next decade.
Okay, we'll keep following that. I'm afraid we got to stop it there. But Congressman Mike Lawler of New York, thanks so much. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
More than 200 Catholic bishops from across the United States are gathered in Baltimore this week for their annual conference. It's their first large gathering since the election of Pope Leo XIV. The Chicago-born Pope has called for deep reflection about the detention of migrants in the U.S. The Catholic bishops elected new leaders of their conference, and immigration led the discussions. Here's Aleja Hertzler-McCain of Religion News Service.
On Monday, the U.S. Catholic bishops elected Archbishop Paul Coakley to be the conference's president for the next 3 years. Coakley is the advisor to an influential group of conservative Catholics whose leader has praised the Trump administration. Runner-up Bishop Daniel Flores of Brownsville, Texas, was elected vice president. Immigration was top of mind for many bishops, one of whom described the situation as a crisis. Bishops said that while they support border security, many innocent people are suffering. Here's Bishop Mark Seitz of El Paso, Texas.
Our immigrant brothers and sisters, from those who are undocumented to those who are naturalized citizens, are living in a deep state of fear.
But bishops also said they face a difficult political environment. Archbishop Timothy Broglio said,
I have also learned and mentioned it to Pope Leo last month that some of our faithful listen more readily to sound bites, the sirens of political discourse, or whatever confirms their conclusions and partisan leanings, than they are to hearing their pastors and us.
The bishops' meeting concludes Thursday. For NPR News, I'm Aleja Hertzler-McCain.
This is NPR News.
And you are listening to Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew DeZingle, and this is KAXE, KBXE. Coming up in a bit, I'll be joined by the franchise, Jen Kellen. We'll be here until 9 o'clock before we hand things over to Kari Hedlund for Headwaters. Do you love music and are interested in becoming an on-air volunteer DJ at KXE, KBXE? On-air volunteers are the lifeblood of our station, and our fall training is coming up Wednesday, November 12th at KAXE in Grand Rapids or at KBXE in Bemidji, Thursday, November 13th. Both classes run 5:30 to 7 p.m. Email volunteer at kaxe.org for more info or to confirm attendance. Take part in community read-in at the Bemidji Public Library from 5 to 6 p.m. Mondays in November. Gather to read quietly, demonstrate support, and celebrate the library. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is looking for people to collect tree seeds and cones this fall and winter. Current high-demand species include jack pine, black spruce, and red pine. Visit mndnr.gov/seedcone for more information. After Dark is KXE's Saturday night program after green cheese from 9 to midnight, featuring styles of music like punk, metal, EDM, R&B, hip-hop, and more. Interested in hosting? Email dgannon@kaxe.org. Now back to Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV. With new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals whose ideas, solutions, and discoveries expand people's expectations of what's possible. MacFound.org. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. There's a fight for the future of the Democratic Party. A 26-year-old political strategist named Morris Katz is the tip of the spear. He's been backing candidates like 34-year-old Democratic socialist Zohran Mamdani, who won the mayor's race in New York City last week. I asked him recently about what happened in New York and the way the Democrats have reacted.
You know, Andrew Cuomo, his super PAC was running attack ads with the word jihadist stamped on Zohran's forehead. There are people who want to still live in this kind of pre-2008 world, and that's not where we are anymore. What people are frustrated with is a politics of politeness in the face of deep division, in the face of deep income inequality.
You also saw Democrats, people like Pete Buttigieg, not congratulating Mamdani, which was arguably the most watched race in the country, even though it's typically a Democrat who wins that seat.
I think one thing I'd say is I think that anyone who's scared to congratulate Zohran publicly or privately is very unlikely to be the nominee for president in 2028. I don't know how you look at someone who turned out young voters at an unprecedented level, who won back immigrant communities that helped deliver Donald Trump his victory, and say that there's nothing worth celebrating there.
You've said in the past, this race was about defeating more than Andrew Cuomo, but the politics of Andrew Cuomo. You called it the pettiness and desperation for power that's willing to sell anyone out. It's a rot that's at the core of everything that's wrong with our politics and the party. Tell me more about what you meant here.
When you look at our party, when you look at the results of the past election, the reality is we had the White House for 12 out of 16 years. During that time, had control of both chambers multiple times, have governor mansions under our jurisdiction, and things have gotten worse. Income inequality has gone up, quality of life has gone down, mental illness is on the rise, depression is on the rise. We would be doing a deep disservice to our party and to the country if we were not looking in the mirror. We've become incredibly complacent with a status quo that's literally killing people, that's literally allowing people to be pushed out of their homes. Kids can't afford college. And so I think we don't need to be this party. We don't need to be scared of our own shadow. We don't have to be scared of billionaires and lobbyists and corporations. And I think we started that work in New York and hopefully can continue it.
You've worked with other candidates and are working with other Democratic candidates. And candidates, a lot of the times, the establishment of the party don't like, don't back, don't support. How do you see your role? Are you trying to remake this party?
I think I want to see a party that reflects what this country looks like. And I think right now we have a party that reflects what a lot of different C-suites and Ivy League reunions look like. You know, like Congress should be a place where we have farmers and where we have mechanics, as well as having lawyers, as well as having business owners. And I think, you know, it's only 2% of Congress right now is from the working class. For so many in power right now, it's been decades since they were actually working a 9-to-5, or since they knew what it means to struggle to make that mortgage payment or put your kid through pre-K. And so when I talk to candidates, I look for an authenticity, a clear vision of what's wrong and what needs to be better. Are you willing to listen to constituents, or are you more connected and beholden to lobbyists and donors and a status quo? And I think so many of those in power right now spend far more time talking to donors than they do to their district.
Kat sees that in Graham Plattner, a military veteran, an oyster farmer in Maine, trying to unseat five-term Republican Senator Susan Collins. But he's been mired in controversy in recent weeks. Old online posts surfaced showing Plattner playing down sexual assault in the military, saying things like black people don't tip and rural Americans are racist and stupid. Soon after that, a tattoo on his chest, widely recognized as a Nazi symbol, also came to light. Plattner disavowed the comments, saying they were from a dark time in his life. He's covered up the tattoo, apologized for it, and says he didn't know what it meant when he got it. Katz is still working with Plattner going into this primary as a political strategist.
If we want to move past a time in which the only people who are able to run for office are people who, since they were children, had been planning a run for office, or who have closely choreographed every move to position them for a run for statewide office or for a run for president, that's going to require running real people. And real people who haven't thought they're going to run for office have lived imperfect lives. You know, like, we're dealing with a mass kind of loss of young men in the Democratic Party, angry young men who are lost to, you know, the internet, to different podcasts or to different, you know, Reddit threads. And then we have someone in Graham who was a person who was struggling, who after four tours in the Middle East came back and has talked about openly his PTSD, his depression, and who then came out the other side. And to me, that's the perfect messenger to win back those young men.
But you don't feel like this is disqualifying.
If voters feel like it's disqualifying, it's up to them. That's why we have primaries, and that's why we have elections. But I think an era in which, like, Washington, D.C. gets to decide that that's a liability or that that's disqualifying is out of touch with the real craving for real human beings who are relatable and authentic, flaws and all.
These details all emerged after Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer recruited Maine Governor Janet Mills to join the Democratic primary field.
I think you have a culture in the Democratic Party establishment of being so protective of the status quo that there's even a desire to kind of eat your own.
Interesting.
And, you know, like someone like Graham Plattner, who went, like, might not even have been 20 yet when he served his first tour in a war that many of these senators voted to send him to, who is the exact kind of Democrat, the exact kind of person that we have been talking about since 2016. How do we win back? And then we have him, and the response is to attack him, to take things out of context, to throw everything you've got at him, despite the excitement he's bringing, despite what he's bringing to this party. Feels frustrating. You know, that's not moving us any closer to getting a Senate majority back.
That's political strategist and ad maker Morris Katz talking about the future of the Democratic Party. This is NPR News.
The International Space Station has been orbiting Earth for 25 years now, and astronauts aboard have had to follow some key rules for staying alive in space.
You always have to respect the laws of physics and recognize that the laws of physics will always win.
I'm Scott Detrow. A new documentary tells the origins of the ISS on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered later today at 4 o'clock with your local host, Jennifer Barr. You're tuned in to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew DeZingle here with the franchise, Jen Kellen.
Morning, Andrew.
Good morning. It's pretty dark out. Well, actually, the sun is starting to pop out a little bit there.
Starting to peak. Get a little... The northern lights were sure bright.
You said you could still see them this morning.
Yes. I got up about 5, and they were crazy. Like, so red. You know, they were very intense.
Yeah, you almost decide not to come in.
I mean, how can you walk away from that? You could not see them in the big city here, though, huh?
Not where I live, in the middle of town. Like, okay. I couldn't see any lights.
They were crazy last night, too. Spent way too much time on
them. You know, I thought about driving out, but I was, just because I had the morning show this morning, I didn't want to stay up late, but then I ended up staying late anyway.
You could have.
Yeah, I could have.
At some point, when you weren't falling asleep, you should have just been like...
I should have been like, yep, I'm just going to go for it.
Yep.
Well, it was kind of like that weird, like, you're not sleeping, but you're like so calm.
Yeah, time you're is just resting.
By. Yeah.
Yeah. Our cat was going crazy last night, and we wondered if... Do Northern Lights affect animals?
Well, the moon affects wolves, doesn't it?
The moon affects us all. Does it affect wolves more? I don't know. Somebody knows.
Well, like, what was the cat doing?
Just, like, frisky, like, running around. Like, wanted to be inside, wanted to be outside, wanted to be inside. Just, like, running around.
Well, I guess the cat probably has better eyesight, so maybe they get to see, like, what our cameras pick up.
Yeah,
the
maybe.
Lights.
Maybe.
And it was just like, I can't comprehend what's happening right now. Right. And I don't know what I should be doing.
So I'm going to bat at your leg a little bit and jump around. I don't know. I'd be curious. If anyone knows that, text in, please, and let us know if Northern Lights affect animals or other things. I mean, it affects, like, radar and stuff, right?
Like, for owls, what would it do for them?
For the, yeah.
Because, like, all of a sudden it's... Wait a minute, it's supposed to be really dark here, and I'm supposed to be, like,
what's going
predator
on?
Number one out here.
Right.
All of a sudden, everyone can see everything.
It's blowing my cover. I don't know if they're supposed to happen again tonight. Have you heard?
I don't know for sure.
Well, if they do, I'd recommend.
Well, tonight, yeah, I would go out tonight.
You can catch a nap this afternoon and then head out.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That is the franchise, Jen Killen. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We've got quite the morning show for you today. We are going to be joined by Jack Nackbar, talking about the classic movie series going on at Edge Center for the Arts.
Good.
Talking Rio Bravo.
Huh.
Have you seen Rio Bravo, Jen?
I have not seen the whole thing.
But you know of it.
It's an old John Wayne Western, right?
Yes.
And I think I've seen little snippets of it here and there, you know, on reruns.
Yeah, I definitely
stuff.
Remember seeing it, like, on AMC or TCM.
Okay.
I'm not sure which, like, growing up kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, kind of a standard Saturday Western thing.
Have you seen the whole thing recently?
Within the last 5 years, I have.
Okay. Now, you're a movie guy.
I sure am.
Cinephile, even?
Sure, why not?
Okay. Movie buff, for sure. Do you like a Western?
I like Westerns.
Yeah?
Yeah. Rio Bravo, I enjoy. I think more because of, like, I'm a big fan of Howard Hawks, the director.
Okay.
He made a lot of my favorite movies of all time.
Like
Bringing Up Baby, which is a comedy with Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn.
Okay, yeah.
I'd put that in my top 10 movies of all time.
Oh, wow.
Balls of Fire, which is pretty good. He made the original Scarface.
Oh, okay.
With Paul Mooney.
Okay. When did the original one come out?
Gosh, 1931 or 32 kind of thing.
Is it as brutal as the remake? When did I'm thinking like, was there like a Scarface in the 80s?
Yep, with Al Pacino.
Okay.
The original one, I bet it was, I think it was considered pretty violent for its time kind of thing.
Okay. In the 80s, my mom had to spend some of Scarface in the lobby of the movie theater because she thought she was going to pass out from all the violence.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she does not like blood, so she had to just take a break in the lobby for a while. So yeah, that's what I remember.
This is a controversial take because Scarface is kind of like a college dorm room classic in terms of posters and whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the movie is okay. I don't love it.
Okay. it's got a bigger reputation than
I think it goes on for too long. There's like definitely very memorable scenes in it kind of thing, but overall the movie, I'm not a huge fan of it. I like the original actually better.
Yeah, I would be interested in trying to see the original maybe.
I've got it on DVD, Jen.
Do you? Okay. Yep. I don't have a DVD.
You don't have a DVD player?
No.
Oh, wow.
That makes a lot of sense to you, doesn't it?
Well.
Now that you hear it.
Not really, because that means you're like, you don't have a DVD player, so you're just all streaming. But you're not the type of person where it's like, I'm a streamer.
No. I am not a streamer. Although we started, now that summer,
now that it's getting cooler,
it's darker, it's cold, we started, we picked up with the series The Diplomat again last night.
The Diplomat, who is in that? Let me try to guess. It's not Gillian Anderson, is it?
No.
Okay, who is it?
It's the woman that's in The Americans.
Oh, Carrie Russell.
Yes, Carrie Russell. We watched the first two seasons of The Diplomat. Season 3 came out this year, and we just watched episode 1. It was very good.
Excellent. So, right now, I'm rewatching Eastbound and Down.
What's that?
It was an HBO show starring Danny McBride as a washed-up baseball player.
Oh.
We're in the final season.
Oh, okay. How many seasons?
4.
Okay.
But they're like maybe 10 episodes each, so.
Okay.
It's been cruising along.
Yeah.
Half-hour show.
Recommend?
I enjoy it. Yeah. I wouldn't recommend it for everybody.
Okay.
It's like very dark humor.
Well, that's right up my alley. And it's about baseball.
Yeah. We receive support from the Bonner Eye Clinic with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, offering cataract surgery, LASIK, and general eye exams. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly.
Programming on KXE is supported in part by the Minnesota Humanities Center, distributing more than $6 million in cultural heritage grants. Funding is available to individuals and organizations that will create, celebrate, and teach Minnesota's diverse arts, culture, and heritage, including Indigenous organizations, historically underrepresented communities, and recent immigrants and veterans. Details at mnhum.org/grants.
Time now for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Without reliable internet, it's tough for veterans to apply for and access financial and health benefits, including mental health care. But as KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, a Phoenix-based telehealth company and the Arizona Department of Veteran Services are partnering to help better equip those living on remote tribal lands.
So far, Janice Tallis Denny, who is Hopi and with the company Televeda, has delivered 16 military-grade kits containing Starlink satellite internet systems at no cost to nearly a dozen Arizona tribes beginning this year in Parker.
If I can do it, anybody can do this.
Her latest stop, New Pasqua, is just on the outskirts of Tucson.
It's a hot day today. We don't want to be out here too long.
Along with her is Dylan Delzato on behalf of the Arizona Department of Veterans Services.
Let's start with 50 of them, see where it goes, and here we are rather quickly. Excited to get the rest of them out there. And a big roadblock for a lot of vets is the internet connectivity.
Especially on tribal lands. Carmen Rivera is the Pascua Yaqui Tribe's Veterans Benefits Counselor and often travels to the Mexico border, meeting with tribal members living off-grid.
And when you give them, you know, information, whether it be off of this system or you give it to them in paper, they like that.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Oklahoma Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen is facing criticism for an exchange during a recent hearing on federal recognition for the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina. He's accused of racial stereotyping based on looks. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
Senator Mullen's an enrolled member of the Cherokee Nation, but that doesn't give him a pass with tribal leaders. During a recent hearing over whether or not to recognize the Lumbee, Mullen offended many with his exchange with Principal Chief Michelle Hicks of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indian.
You can't look over there and say they're not Native. I mean, turn around and look, and you're telling me they're not Native?
I've seen the crowd.
Okay, and you're saying that that's not Native faces?
That's not for me to determine. That's
no, but we are determining it.
Nevada Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto has garnered praise across Indian country for calling Mullen out.
It's just like my frustration with this administration giving authority to ICE to pull anybody over that just because they have brown skin and claim that they're undocumented somehow. I think it's wrong. I don't want to be put in a position like that.
Mullen brushes the criticism aside.
I don't care if I'm doing what is right. The Lumbees deserve to be recognized.
A 2022 Congressional Budget Office study estimated it would cost just over $90 million a year to recognize the Lumbee. Mullen says concerns raised by other tribes over the cost of enrolling the Lumbee, coupled with debates over gaming, are misguided.
I mean, I'm serious. It doesn't make any sense. Yeah. And if you're going to start talking about gaming, which most of these arguments are about is gaming, shame on you. Because now you're putting profit over Native people.
Well, North Carolina's two Republican U.S. senators are pushing the Lumbee Fairness Act, which would recognize the tribe federally. Senator Cortez Masto says that's a decision best left up to nonpartisan officials within the Interior Department.
I am not equipped to make that determination, and that's why that was set up that way. It's evidence-based. I rely on it.
President Donald Trump has promised the Lumbee federal recognition. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kohanic Broadcast Corporation, funded by the Annenberg Foundation and the Ford Foundation. You're tuned in to the Wednesday morning show. I'm Andrew Zingle here with the franchise, Jen Killen. Coming up in a bit, we're going to hear more from Morning Edition, talking about uncertain future for tradeswomen and Netflix big screens. That'll be coming up in just a moment. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a lifestyle magazine since 1997, a local publication sharing stories from the heart of Minnesota about the places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. LakeCountryJournal.com.
Support also comes from Minnesota Power, an elite company, envisioning a carbon-free future through their energy forward strategy. More at mnpower.com/energyforward.
And don't forget, we have our question of the week. We'll talk about this a little bit later, Jen, but the question of the week is, what do you remember about your home ec and shop classes? Tell us about your projects at 218-326-1234. So start thinking, Jen, about all those projects you worked on.
Okay. I got it.
You got it? All right.
I could talk about it right now.
Well, you'll just have to wait. And coming up later in the show, we're going to be talking classic movies with Jack Nackbar. We're talking Rio Bravo, starring John Wayne, Dean Martin, Ricky Nelson. Were you a Dean Martin or Ricky Nelson music fan?
Yeah, you gotta like Dean Martin. I just picture like low ball glasses with ice cubes tinking.
Yeah, I had a Rat Pack phase in high school for a while where I got the Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra Greatest Hits type CDs and just listened to them over and over again.
Yeah,
Dean Martin I liked more than Frank Sinatra.
Did you?
And gosh, I could sing you like 10 different Dean Martin songs.
Just give me a little snippet of one.
Hey, Mambo! Mambo Italiano, hey Mambo, Mambo Italiano.
Do you have that on vinyl?
No, just the, I wish I did.
We should do it from the vault.
I wonder if we can find that one.
That's what I think of when I think of the Rat Pack and Dean Martin, and it's not very Rat Pack-ish, but my grandpa had all their Christmas vinyl, you know, Christmas Eve, I picture.
I have two Dean Martin records. And one of them I got because it has one of my favorite songs of his called In the Chapel in the Moonlight.
Okay.
It's a very good song.
Yeah? Do we get a snippet of that one? Okay. We should dig in the vault.
Yeah, we should see if there's a Dean Martin record back there.
That'd be fun. We could dust it off.
So while we're doing that, we're going to leave you with Morning Edition here talking about uncertain future for tradeswomen and Netflix big screens here on the Wednesday Morning Show.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Women make up less than 5% of the construction trades, professions such as carpenter, electrician, and plumber. President Trump wants to grow the industry, but there are fears women could be further sidelined. Some labor unions say they won't let that happen. Here's NPR's Andrea Hsu.
At the Plumbers Union Training Center in Chicago, first-year apprentices in safety goggles gather around an instructor. One at a time, they step up to saw off a piece of white plastic piping.
Looks like they're practicing cutting PVC, what they need to do to prep it, the glue.
Sarah Kirkos has been through this training. She's now a third-year apprentice and has two more years to go before becoming a full-fledged union plumber, a $60-an-hour job with excellent benefits. Already, she's earning half that. It's proving to be a good career, she says, but not one that a lot of other women are flocking to.
There's always that breath of fresh air when you see another lady there.
The Plumbers Union has been trying to recruit more women, starting with high schoolers. They're putting women in leadership roles and creating opportunities for women to network and support each other. Kirkos is confident there will be plenty of work now that she knows how to do things like
water tapping. So we're replacing all the lead pipes in Chicago. We're trying to. We're starting to.
And the union says there's value to having women on the job. Sandro D'Andrea is an instructor here. He's been a plumber for 25 years.
I feel they're more detail-minded than the men.
He says some of the women outwork the men, and they bring a different vibe.
Actually, the women bring a sense of calm to the classroom.
Labor advocates credit the government with getting women into construction in the first place. For more than four decades, the Labor Department had a goal for federal contractors and subcontractors.
6.9% of construction hours were supposed to be worked by women.
That's former Labor Department attorney Donna Lenhoff. She says the 6.9% was never a quota, but it forced companies to make good faith efforts to bring women into the trades.
These things have an impact on people and certainly on women who thought, okay, now the door is open.
For 60 years, an executive order signed by President Lyndon B. Johnson also compelled federal contractors to take proactive steps to ensure they weren't discriminating against anyone. But now under President Trump,
it's gone, so federal contractors no longer have any special obligations.
Lenhoff says that could spell devastation for women in construction, given how many builders get federal dollars. In a statement, White House spokesman Kush Desai responded, writing, "Instead of DEI boondoggles that accomplish nothing, the Trump administration is laying the groundwork for Americans of all backgrounds to help build our next golden age." Now, already, one giant union has responded to Trump's policies targeting identity-based initiatives. The United Brotherhood of Carpenters ended its Sisters in the Brotherhood program, which had supported women carpenters for decades. But other unions say they're forging ahead. Their resolve was on display at a conference of more than 5,000 tradeswomen this fall. From the opening reception through every panel, the sentiment was strength in numbers. Jessica Bruno traveled in from Minnesota, where she maintains and repairs all kinds of boilers.
Big powerhouse boilers, garbage burners, paper mills.
There are not a lot of female boiler makers out there, but Bruno thinks there could be more. She says not only do women excel at tasks like welding, some women have a size advantage.
Some of the jobs you go on, it's like, you got to have somebody that's smaller to be able to fit into that pipe or that tube. And you look at all the guys and you're like, all right, well, I'm going in there.
She's 5'2", by the way. The Painters Union has a goal to be 20% women by 2029. Their president, Jimmy Williams, says a tax on DEI won't change that.
Equity is what we do as a labor union. It doesn't matter if you're a woman or if you're a male, you get paid the same.
And he says plenty of companies are on board too.
Especially in commercial paint and wall covering, drywall finishing, those employers legitimately have been trying to increase the number of women because they see that there is an added value here. They're extremely talented.
Now, no one at the conference spoke publicly about President Trump, how his policies or his views about organized labor might affect their future. But Sean McGarvey came close. He's president of North America's Building Trades Unions.
This is more than just a project. These are fights about our values. Values like diversity, equity, inclusion, and solidarity.
His message was, let's keep opening doors.
We don't give a what they're saying and doing in Washington. We are staying on the course we're on.
Plenty of cheers for that. Andrea Hsu, NPR News, Chicago.
Netflix started as a way to watch movies without going to a theater. People received discs in the mail at first. Then technology changed, and people on Netflix stream whatever they want. Now Netflix is innovating again. The company founded to save you the trouble of going to a theater is inviting you to go to a theater. At Netflix House in a Philadelphia suburb, NPR's Netta Ulaby did.
This Netflix House is not a house. It's a former Lord & Taylor department store at the King of Prussia Mall. You can watch movies there, you can play mini golf there, you can buy merch and take selfies. Like on a shabby living room couch on what looks like a set from the show Stranger Things. Getting fans to post such selfies is good marketing for Netflix, says Paul DeGarabedian. He studies marketplace trends for research firm Comscore. The company's strategy, he says, is also designed to attract fans jumpy about spending money right now.
It's free to go in and to explore, but then they want to upgrade you. They want to upsell you for these multimedia experiences, immersive VR games.
One of them is a $40 immersive experience based on the show Wednesday, about the spooky Addams Family daughter. The company plans to open its second Netflix House in Dallas, Texas next month, says Chief Marketing Officer Marion Lee.
I would love it to be in every major city around the world.
Lee says the Dallas location will not even have a movie theater. And these physical Netflix houses will give the company information about local fans and their interests that even sophisticated algorithms are unable to discern. And they help make up for something lots of other streaming services have, a connection to an amusement park where fans can have experiences based on their favorite characters and shows. Disney, also the parent company of Hulu. Universal Studios is a corporate sibling of NBC's Peacock. Netflix House is more about multimedia experiences than a roller coaster based on Bridgerton, but the Dallas one has something even scarier in store for fans. An immersive virtual version of Squid Game. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Full disclosure, Universal Studios is a division of NBC Universal, which is a supporter of NPR. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez.
Morning Edition here on the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew Zingle here with the franchise, Jen Killen, and we've got a little special surprise for you, Jen.
All right. I can't wait.
A boy went back to Napoli because he missed the scenery, the native dances and the charming songs. But wait a minute. Something's wrong.
That's what I was
thinking. Hey,
Mambo, Mambo Italiano, hey, Mambo, Mambo Italiano, go, go, go. You mixed up a Siciliano, all you Calabrese do the Mambo like a crazy with the hey, Mambo. Don't wanna tarantala, hey, Mambo, no more mozzarella, hey, Mambo, Mambo Italiano, try it.
What'd you think?
You gotta give me time to get back to my chair. Dancing.
It's hard not to dance to that song.
It is. Well, how old were you when you hit your Rat Pack?
Gosh, I was maybe, I want to say 10th grade, 10th okay. or 11th grade.
And you were probably the only guy in the 10th grade in a Rat Pack phase?
Yeah, I think that was safe to say.
Yeah. Did you share that phase with your friends?
No, just with my theater friends.
Oh, okay.
We would that talk one. About it.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
that's like, that's what I would audition with, was oh, with right. Rat Pack song, yeah. Rat Pack songs.
Nice.
If I can remember correctly, I did Yes I Can by Sammy Davis Jr.
Nice.
And then I did a Frank Sinatra. I think I did I've Got the World on a String, maybe.
Sure.
And
yeah.
then the other one, I think, was Dean Martin, Everybody Loves Somebody.
Okay.
I think that's what I did.
I like the song, I've Got the World on a String. I saw a really, really memorably bad, like, interpretive dance to that song.
Oh, no.
So that's what I think of when I see that song. So, and that was years ago, but that still comes to mind. Like, I hear that song or I hear somebody say it.
So, like, they were playing the Frank Sinatra song, or was it a different version of the song?
They were playing the song, but then, like, doing some...
But it was the Frank Sinatra
yeah.
version. Wow.
Yeah.
I want to see this.
No, you don't.
Well, speaking of seeing live stuff, you also went to some live music this weekend.
Yeah. Got to see S.G. Goodman.
For the second time
for
in your
life. For the second time. Yeah.
Got and to see how her. Was it?
It was fantastic. It was really, really, really good. Of course, saw her at Riverfest in 2024.
Mm-hmm.
And I was familiar-ish with her before 2024. And then when I saw her there, I was like, wow, I kind of love her. And then she came out with this new album this year, Planting by the Signs.
Which you were a fan of.
I am surprised you didn't get tired of hearing me say, oh my gosh, I love this album. But I love this album. It's so good. So when I saw she was going to be at Fine Line, I jumped at the tickets.
And how was the Fine Line?
It was good.
Because it gets a bad rap, the Fine Line.
Yeah. No, I enjoyed it. It was perfect venue to see her.
How close did you get?
Just right.
What does that mean?
Like, not super close, but I mean, I could see her the whole show.
Uh-huh.
And it was like, it was good. Good crowd. Great. She started the show by playing like the first two songs off the album right in order.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, oh.
Played the whole album.
Yeah, are we going to do this? But she didn't. But she played almost everything from the new album. And then went off, came back for a little encore, played Space and Time. You know that song.
Yeah.
Super famous. And then guess what she closed with?
Was it a cover?
Yep.
Okay. Life on Mars?
Nope.
Give me a hint. I have to guess from every song that's ever existed. I've Got the World on a String.
It was Hey Mambo. No. Pepper by the Butthole Surfers.
Oh.
That was fantastic.
Wow.
It was so great. Very, very good. Your friend and mine, Malachi Coons, was at the show too.
Oh. Where was he?
He was holding up the line for us to get it. No. No, he was within arm's reach.
What'd he think of the show, Jeter?
He thought it was great.
All right.
So, and, you know, he's the music expert, so you should trust his review.
But you're the huge S.G. Goodman fan. I guess I don't know which one of you is the biggest fan.
Yeah, I don't know either. I don't know either.
You got the merch. You got the shirt.
Got the shirt.
Did you get the record?
No.
CDs? Do you have a CD player? As it's been established, you do not have a DVD player.
Have a DVD. Do we have a CD player anywhere still? We have a couple really old cars. I bet they still have CDs.
Yeah, you could definitely do it there.
Yeah.
Could get in there, go to see the Northern Lights.
Yeah, drive around, listen to the SG CD.
Yeah.
That's what I'm doing tonight.
Except you know, it's a good driving song, though. Call Me the Breeze.
Yes, it is.
For some reason, that was my first thought of what you could listen to in your car.
Oh, really? I always think of Tom Petty when I think of driving music.
Oh, I was just listening to Tom Petty the other day.
Well, you started your...
That's right.
Monday?
I was like, when did I listen to it? Oh, yeah, here on the radio.
We were all listening to it, Andrew, because you were playing it. No, I always like that because I remember hearing an interview with him. Like when they're in studio recording something, if they felt kind of stuck, they would jump in the car and listen to it while they're driving to see, like, that was their benchmark. If it was,
I could definitely, drivable. I would say their most drivey song is Running Down a Dream.
Yes.
That one's got the most car vibes.
Yep. That's a good one.
But man, listening to Wildflowers in the car when you're just like traveling in the countryside kind of thing, there's nothing better.
No, that's right.
But
I agree.
Speaking of music, we're going to listen to a tune right now. Cat Power. It's the 20th anniversary of her album, The Greatest, and she's releasing some songs, I think, from the recording of it, and this is one of them. This is Cat Power with the song, Try Me.
Try me. Try me. Darling, tell me.